This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the second week of June, and this week, President Trump told ABC News' George Stephanopoulos he'd listen if a foreign power came to him with dirt on his 2020 opponent. Here's a clip from that interview.
Your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI if I thought there was something wrong. But when somebody comes up with oppo research, right, they come up with oppo research. Oh, let's call the FBI. The FBI doesn't have enough agents to take care of it. But you go and talk honestly to congressmen. They all do it. They always have. And that's the way it is. It's called oppo research.
This statement drew widespread criticism from Democrats and louder criticism than usual from Republicans. Utah Senator Mitt Romney said taking such information from a foreign power, quote, simply strikes at the heart of our democracy. It's wrong. It's antithetical to our democratic principles, unquote. But Trump seems unmoved, and the Republican-controlled Senate has little interest in taking up either Democratic or bipartisan proposals to improve election security and combat foreign influence in U.S. elections. We will talk about that shortly. Later in the show, we'll take a look from the ground in Iowa. Politico reporter Natasha Karecki will join us to talk about who's making the best impressions on voters and activists who will go first in choosing the next Democratic presidential nominee. And Iowa City-based writer Carrie Howley will also join us to discuss her feature story for New York Magazine about Hawaii Congresswoman and presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard and her very unusual political journey. But now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hey, Josh.
How's it going, Josh?
Rich, I want to start with the president's statement that he might accept opposition research from a foreign power if it was offered to him again. And I think this gets a little bit abstracted from the facts on the ground. The problem with taking information from Russia was not a purely abstract one about foreign source information. It's that Russia was offering the information for the purposes of destabilizing U.S. politics and undermining alliances between the U.S. and its Western European allies. And it's that Russia was obtaining the information through criminal acts, and both of those facts were pretty obvious. At the time, the Trump associates were seeking that information from Russia. And this seems to me is the distinction the president elides. He likes to throw out names like Norway. Norway is a friendly power. Russia is a hostile power. He doesn't seem to see that as a relevant distinction.
I see this as a little bit of fake controversy. I see Trump driven by probably overwhelmingly the desire not to have to admit that Don Jr. made a mistake and a very bad judgment in taking this meeting at Trump Tower, which is the focus of so much of the Russia story. But the likelihood that anyone in the Trump campaign is going to get a call from a representative of the Russian or Chinese, those are the examples that George Stephanopoulos threw out, government, and just take the call and, yeah, let's have the meeting after the experience of these 3 years of agony over this potential criminal exposure for Don Jr., no one would possibly do it. But obviously, the right answer here and the answer that would cause much less turmoil and unnecessary controversy is, yeah, of course we'd call the FBI, but he doesn't want to say that.
Liz, one thing that George Stephanopoulos pointed out in this interview was that someone during the 2000 campaign, someone stole a videotape of George W. Bush's debate prep and sent it to the Gore campaign. And Gore staffers figured out what the tape was, immediately stopped it, called the police instead of watching it. Was Al Gore a sucker?
In many ways, yes. I mean, there are elements of suckertude to anybody who doesn't take an unearned advantage. But nonetheless, there's still probably a moral edge there.
Do you agree with Rich that this is a fake controversy?
I think that Trump was really kind of half-heartedly riffing on the question. He didn't seem to have put much thought into it. I do assume that his number one motive is trying to maintain some kind of consistency where he doesn't have to condemn what members of his own family did. So it's a controversy that is not fake. It exists. It's just part of a long-running controversy that I think we all know about and are exposed to by now.
Rich, I guess the question is, even if this is purely a hypothetical, and I agree with you that it is probably purely a hypothetical, and I don't think they will face a situation exactly like they faced in 2016. The Trump Tower meeting also did not produce the documents that they hoped it would, and they did hope that it would. I mean, Don Jr. did say in that text message, if it's what you say it is, I love it.
He would have taken it. Right. If they had it, he would have taken it.
Right. But doesn't the principle and the public statement matter here? I mean, I think that's what Mitt Romney is really talking about in his statement, that it's important to have a president who says the right things about these things, even if he's not going to be faced with the literal choice about doing them.
Yes. Yeah. He should have said, no, we're not going to take it. It was a mistake to take it or be willing to take it the first time. And he easily – this is just another example. It's just – it's not hard to come up with an answer that doesn't throw your son over the bus but says the right under the bus. Throwing him over the bus would be some doing. But just to say, look, he was new to politics. He's new to this. He shouldn't have taken the call in retrospect, and we wouldn't do it this time around. But Trump never takes that kind of out.
Liz, what have you been watching this week?
On Thursday, explosions caused by mines damaged a pair of oil tankers, one Japanese-owned, one Norwegian-owned, in the Gulf of Oman, through which one-fifth of the world's global oil supply passes. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has openly blamed Iran for the attacks, though no hard evidence has yet emerged supporting his account, and other governments such as Germany haven't accepted Pompeo's version of events. Of course, even if some Iranian group or faction were responsible, I think most would distinguish that from a concerted governmental action on behalf of Tehran. But no such distinctions being made, at least by Americans who seem to want to move to war footing, and that's deeply disturbing, a Gulf of Tonkin for our times. One case bashful Trump supporters were always able to make to skeptics was that among the 2016 Republican field, Trump alone seemed truly opposed to the disastrous endless wars of the 21st century, namely Iraq and Afghanistan. And though he promised not to drag us into similar conflicts, it's no longer clear to me the president's going to be able to stop members of administration like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo from pushing as hard as they can for war with Iran. And that's very worrying.
So before we get into what to do about this, let's talk a little bit about the merits of the evidence here. And you have this video that the U.S. State Department has put out that they say is Iranian forces removing a non-activated mine from one of these ships, essentially trying to remove evidence of Iran's involvement in this. Britain has said that they do share the U.S. assessment that Iran is behind this. But then you also have statements from the owner of one of these vessels, which is a Japanese vessel, basically saying that whatever was shot at the ship was above the waterline, and so it can't have been a mine. And so the U.S. account of what happened here is not correct, at least as regards his ship. So, Rich, what do you make of this? How sure can we feel about the idea that Iran is behind these attacks?
I think pretty certain. I mean, the video seems fairly compelling. It's just the idea that the Saudis or someone would undertake some operation to try to frame the Iranians at enormous risk. Now, we've seen the leaders of Saudi Arabia carry out an assassination that was extremely foolish as well.
They have been reckless in a number of ways.
But it seems, if the British intelligence is pointing that way as well. And intelligence, it's never 100%, right? But that's why it's just intelligence and not just flat-out fact or evidence. But it seems very likely that this is an Iranian operation. They have the forces to do this. They've done it before. The question is motive, which is it seems bizarre for their purposes, but this may be a product of factions within the regime, or just kind of lashing out in the hope of stirring the pot, increases your leverage somehow. But I have a little doubt it's the Iranians.
Well, Liz, if this is Iran, isn't the theory of why they would do this essentially that they want to demonstrate the damage they could do to shipping through this strait if there were more serious U.S. actions toward Iran, basically as a threat? Look what we can do to the global oil trade if you attack us. I mean, this is something that Iran has done in the past, and conceivably it's something that they would have a motive to do now.
Right, and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was there, theoretically to try to get some concessions or bring Iran back to the negotiating table, which apparently didn't work out. So you can see a certain faction of Iranian forces saying, look, this is a deterrent. You can't force us into taking on greater sanctions or making more concessions. We have control over the global oil supply or in terms of shipping. in a way that gives us some serious power. So you need to negotiate with us more on our terms, less on yours. That would be the theory behind it. But like I said, even if that's a faction within Iran, it's hard to blame Tehran itself as though this were a concerted and planned governmental action, which would press the U.S. to take a more serious retaliatory stance.
So what do you see as something to be done about this then, Liz?
I mean, I think it's probably largely a result of sanctions, right? I mean, Iran has suffered terribly under sanctions. And when we put economic sanctions on other countries, it's not just the government that we're trying to pressure that suffers. The government suffers because the actual working people of the country are suffering. So I've always been in favor of negotiations with Iran that take seriously the idea that those sanctions have been probably too punitive and have caused too much damage to get real negotiations off the ground. So, I mean, I know it's counterintuitive, but I would hope the United States would take a more diplomatic approach than we're likely going to.
Rich, what do you see as a proportionate reaction to this?
Might have to hit something. Just to make it clear, this is completely unacceptable. Now, obviously, the risks to doing that, the risks of an escalation, but you want to, I think, maintain some deterrence and make it clear that any action like this will be met with a reaction that's even stronger.
But then you say a risk of escalation. I mean, isn't that's a big thing to worry about, right? You would not want a diplomatic miscalculation here about exactly what constituted a proportionate response to lead us into a war with Iran that could have been avoided.
Very sensitive, obviously, but you can't have a foreign government mining and blowing up shipping in the straits there. And it's an important global good to have freedom of navigation of the seas, and this is a threat to it.
Rich, what have you been watching this week?
Well, the tariff war, speaking of shots fired, is off for now. I thought that Trump might get symbolic concessions from Mexico with the threat. Seems like maybe he's gotten more than that. I don't know how meaningful it'll be that Mexico is supposedly sending 6,000 National Guard troops to their border with Guatemala, but Mexico being willing at least to say that they're extending the Remain in Mexico policy, which is a policy where migrants come across from Mexico, we can send them back to Mexico while their asylum claims are adjudicated here in the United States, is potentially a significant thing. They had this program had existed previously, but had been fairly strictly limited. Now the Mexicans are at least saying that we will take anyone that you can actually return to us. Now there are limits on our logistical ability to do that, but this is meaningful. I think the downside is, one, this was a very risky tack to begin with, and two, now Trump feels emboldened, really thinks tariffing people or threatening to tariff people can work for other policy concessions, and also you see Democrats now, in theory, embracing this tactic if any of them are elected president.
Liz, as with a lot of Trump negotiations, it's unclear exactly what the deliverable is from this. I mean, one thing the president has been pushing for is for Mexico to sign what's called a Safe Third Country Agreement, which would essentially allow us to reject people who come from third countries, seek asylum in the U.S. from Mexico, because we could say, you know, go seek asylum in Mexico. And while it seems Mexico is still unwilling to do that, they're talking about some sort of regional solution that might also involve Guatemala. And so as that's sort of been something the Democrats have been able to say, well, that's off the table because Mexico will not agree to it. If Mexico is going to maybe agree to some sort of regional solution here, is that something that the U.S. should welcome and accept? Or is that something that treats unfairly these people who maybe are not getting to the safety that they need if they end up in Mexico or Guatemala or wherever else?
Right. I mean, it's Mexico responding. So like Rich said, Trump will take it as a victory. On the other hand, is it really a solution to what is a very serious and a globally scaled refugee crisis? No. The United States, if it wants to be proactive about handling the refugee crisis that is pushing people up against its southern border, is to actually lend aid and try to respond in some way to the crises that are on the ground. We've had dozens of good articles recently in the Times and otherwise about what push factors are forcing people out of, you know, especially countries like Guatemala, and forming a sort of safe zone where they can be pent up and held instead of coming to the U.S. southern border doesn't solve any of those problems. So in terms of human misery and the humanitarian crisis at hand, it doesn't solve anything.
Rich, do you have a sense of the opinions within the White House? If we were going to have some sort of regional solution to the crisis in Central America, presumably that would involve reversing some of the steps that Trump has taken in terms of threatening to and actually withdrawing aid from some of those countries in Central America that are struggling so much. Do the Trump officials understand that as something that they need on the table if they're trying to build a cooperative solution to this?
I don't have a good sense of that. My guess, though, is the cutoff in aid is primarily driven by the president himself and not necessarily by people around him. And this is the irony, really, is if one element of solving this crisis is us paying for Mexico's border wall, in effect, rather than the other way around, the president, as the president promised, you know, aiding their efforts to stiffen their enforcement and doing what you can, I mean, there are limits to it, to create better conditions in Honduras and Guatemala. And there's been very good reporting. There's a Washington Post report this week about, you know, declining prices of coffee are a huge driver of out-migration from these countries. Now, the people experiencing that, they're desperate, but they're not legitimately asylum seekers, which is why most of their claims are rejected at the end of the day.
I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk about Democrats in Iowa. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
If you're listening to our show, you're probably someone who appreciates all sides of an argument. So there's another podcast we think you should check out, Intelligence Squared US. America's leading debate series, they bring the most influential thinkers like David Brooks, Arianna Huffington, and Deepak Chopra together to debate contentious topics like free speech, the environment, and religion. It's not about soundbites and pundits, but a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas. Find Intelligence Squared US wherever you get your podcasts. Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. The Iowa caucuses are a mere 33 weeks away, and Democratic candidates are making Iowa their second home. Even Bill de Blasio keeps going there for some reason. But one candidate who hasn't been in Iowa very much is Joe Biden. He visited Iowa this Tuesday and Wednesday and got into a high-profile spat with President Trump, but that was Biden's first visit to the state since April. And as our next guest reports, that has some Iowa Party activists grumbling that he isn't taking the state seriously enough. Biden nonetheless leads the Iowa polls. A CNN Des Moines Register poll released last weekend found him on top with 24%, but other candidates aren't that far behind. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg were at 16%, 15%, and 14% in that poll, respectively. So how competitive is the Iowa landscape, and who could surprise there? To look at that, we're joined now by Natasha Karecki, national correspondent for Politico. Hi, Natasha.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I feel like every cycle we get these stories about Iowa and New Hampshire voters who don't feel like they're getting enough attention. Does that actually lead to voters holding a grudge? How was Biden received when he finally did make his return to Iowa this week?
People in Iowa take their job very serious as the first in the nation caucus state. And they will very often say when you approach them that after they meet a presidential candidate, that, okay, that was fine meeting them once. Now I need to have them in my kitchen or my living room. So they have very high expectations of these people. They want to see them often. They want to have face-to-face conversations with them. They want to be able to ask questions. They feel like that is their duty. So the fact that Biden, first of all, promised that he would be there so often that people would get sick of him, and then went 6 weeks without returning while all these other campaigns held. I think we went through and counted, and all the other top contenders, the top five, had held at least a dozen events apiece while Biden had gone dark in Iowa. So it's going noticed. It is definitely being noticed. However, Biden got a big dose of luck on Tuesday when he arrived. It just so happened that Trump scheduled a visit in Iowa the same day that Biden was there. And this was a great opportunity for Biden to position himself as the, you know, inevitable candidate against Trump. So instead of being at this Hall of Fame dinner, this big dinner that happened on Sunday, where there was 19 campaign candidates got 5 minutes apiece on a stage, Biden skipped that. And he ends up being there on Tuesday and gets a ton of publicity because he decides to go straight at Trump. They release these remarks ahead of time attacking Trump, And so he positions himself in a way, it kind of reinforces this whole notion of, you know, I am the person who beat Trump sort of thing.
Yeah, Rich, it wasn't just Biden going at Trump. It was Trump going at Biden. He called Biden a loser, a sleepy guy, the weakest mentally. He was sort of suggesting that he was too old and losing his faculties. Is there a strategy there? I mean, the president has talked in the past about how he would really like to face Elizabeth Warren as the nominee. It seems like building up Joe Biden and allowing Joe Biden to make this look like a one-on race between Biden and Trump makes it more likely that Biden will be the nominee. Is Biden really, you know, really someone that Trump should want to face in the general election?
Well, I think part of it's just instinctive. You know, Biden's the leader and in the polling and the guy, therefore, that the Trump feels most compelled to shoot at. I think also if you say that Biden is the most likely Democratic nominee, which seems right at the moment, you want to soften him up and you want to, to the extent you can, drive up his unfavorables towards, you know, the general election next year. So I'm not sure. I know it's the clever kind of conventional wisdom that Trump should ignore him. I'm not sure whether that's right. And I also, this conventional wisdom that it helps Biden to have this back and forth, and that's probably right. But I think there's a risk to Biden if you're the front runner seeming to take your nomination for granted and already be engaged in a general election battle rather than courting the primary and voters and caucus goers, who are the ones who will decide whether you're going to be there or not. And yes, Biden's the front runner, but we've seen in some of these state polls, Iowa most importantly, you know, an 8-point lead in Iowa. If we're 10 days before the caucuses, you say you have a pretty good chance, but not a guarantee. And so it's a soft lead.
Liz, some of the attacks that the president has made have seemed specifically designed to try to foster splits within the Democratic Party coalition. He's sort of oddly criticized Joe Biden for being too tough on crime, attacking him over the 1994 crime bill. And then you've also seen some people around the president sort of talking about Biden as a sex pest, trying to resurface some of these issues about uncomfortable touching that have been an issue for Biden in the Democratic primary. Do you think that is something that that animates a lot of Democratic voters? Because it's not showing up yet in the polling. It's not like he has substantial unfavorables among Democratic voters. It's sort of around 10%, which is similar to other top-tier candidates, actually lower than Bernie's. Are those things that really do give a lot of Democrats pause about Biden?
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell if Trump is trying to foster a split with the criminal justice stuff as much as he's trying to ramp up that battle of him versus Biden, seeing as he's been big on sort of demonstrative, although not too substantive, criminal justice reform measures lately involving Kim Kardashian, oddly enough. But in terms of which Democrats it aggravates, I mean, obviously there's a huge number of mainstream Democrats who are not bothered by any of this that they're hearing about Biden, or who haven't heard it, or who don't take it seriously, or who don't trust the sources. But there's obviously also a left flank of the Democratic Party, especially the young Democrats, who do take it very seriously, and at least to my eyes, appear to respond very strongly to those critiques of Biden and take them to heart.
Natasha, are you seeing that on the ground at all in Iowa?
No. So generally, what you hear people say who turn out to these events, and I talk to a lot of them over the course of the week, wasn't so much his ideological leaning. It was all about, can he beat Trump? And these people are not people, by and large, who support Biden per se. They're coming to see him, and they're seeing him because there's this notion already he's the person who can walk in day one and take the job. And he, you know, he's leading in the polls, so he is the person who can beat Trump. So you're hearing a lot less about that, but I still think it's so early, and we haven't hit the debates yet. We haven't gotten to the nitty gritty, and the vast majority of people aren't tuned in. It's just, well, we don't want Trump anymore. If you're a Democrat, we don't want Trump. We want somebody new.
But it is evolving on the ground in Iowa as people have been tuning in over the last few months and the polls have been moving. One thing we've seen is a lot of strengthening for Elizabeth Warren, who is, you know, third, but I guess you could really call it a three-way tie for second in that CNN poll in Iowa. Do you have a sense of what she's doing right there, why it is that she has strengthened so much over the last few months?
One thing she's done was invest early in Iowa. So unlike the rest of the nation, where Joe Biden's he's polling much higher, it's much closer in Iowa because people there are generally just more in tune with all these other candidates. They're on the ground more. They're campaigning everywhere. So Elizabeth Warren, even before this January, before she even announced, had already hired up and started getting people on the ground. She has 50 paid staffers there already. She has dozens of people working across the state. She's recruiting volunteers. She just has a very organized structure on the ground already. And so does Cory Booker. But for Warren, it is a combination of she has the organization on the ground. She's getting there a lot. And she's just starting. She's had a very, very good month. I mean, I think everyone would probably agree with that. She's gotten the most headlines. She's had the policy rollout that the rest of the pack is sort of leading. And all of that, I think, has gone to help bolster her numbers.
Liz, is she in a position to overtake Bernie as the left's candidate? I've seen a lot of discussion over the last few weeks about whether there are really big differences between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders or not, and if they are similar, whether it's sort of a situation where once one becomes more viable than the other, then their supporters ought to bandwagon together because the same people who like one candidate should like the other.
So there are differences between them. I think they're pretty subtle. In 2016, the narrative we had was this sort of outsider far left candidate in Bernie Sanders versus very traditional mainstream sort of 90s Democrat in Clinton. Obviously, that's not the case in this primary field because Warren and Sanders are both in it, and they both kind of run on that populist track. I think, when you're making these distinctions, it's important to keep in mind they probably are important to folks on the left flank of the Democratic Party more than they are to people in the center of the party. And I would hope that what you would see now that Warren has actually leapfrogged Bernie in a couple of national polls and one Nevada poll is that both of them go as far as they can and form a ticket, because I think their differences actually complement one another really nicely.
But I think you see a reason to significantly prefer Sanders over Warren as a candidate, right?
I do. I mean, I understand his argument for a mass movement building. I think that's going to be pretty critical in trying to get the type of changes he has in mind and Elizabeth Warren has in mind. I think Sanders is correct that it's going to be pretty difficult to get the kind of political changes that he envisions and Warren envisions without a permanent mass movement instead of just one electoral victory. So I think there are several reasons to prefer Sanders, but I don't see any major flaws in Warren, right? The gap between Warren and the rest of the candidates for me is also pretty significant. So I don't have any ill will towards her, and I'm excited about her candidacy. Certainly, Sanders fans, if Warren did end up getting the nomination, would have no reason to be completely despairing and crushed.
Rich, Matt Iglesias is someone who writes frequently about the essential similarity between Warren and Sanders. And one thing he likes to point out is that if you talk to bankers on Wall Street, they do not view Warren and Sanders as different. They don't, even though Warren calls herself a capitalist, they don't view her more favorably than they view Sanders. Now, the way I look at this, it sort of goes back to what we were saying about Trump and Russia almost, and that it's important what a president says beyond what their policies are. And so one thing that I think I find more appealing about Warren than Sanders, and I'm sure makes Liz feel more positive about Sanders than Warren, is that the rhetorical commitment to capitalism is important to me, even when you are pointing out that there are all sorts of flaws in the way unfettered capitalism works and restrictions that you need to impose and regulations, that it's better to start your framework from starting from markets and building regulation onto it than starting from central planning and building in market features. And so I think that's important to me, and so maybe that is important to a lot of voters.
Yeah, I think politically also it just seems completely obvious. If you're going to take this basket of left-wing populist economic proposals, does it make more sense in terms of their appeal to the general public to label them as economic patriotism, to borrow the phrase from one of Warren's proposals a week or so ago that got of attention, or to label them socialism, which is a poisonous term in American discourse? And it's just obvious that the Warren label is more appealing. And Sanders, in the socialism speech he gave this week, basically defined it as kind of FDR-style welfare state democratic politics. So if that's all it is, why are you calling it socialist when FDR himself rejected the socialist label in part because I don't think he was a socialist, but in part because he realized you could go too far left in American politics, and that's not a label you want to embrace.
Liz, what do you say to that?
Well, I think Sanders is making a distinction between the type of politics he ultimately has in mind versus the programs that get us there. And I'm personally very attracted to that democratic socialist vision of politics. You know, there are conflicting polls on how Americans respond to democratic socialism. One of the most recent I saw suggested about 4 in 10 Americans actually consider the term to be a positive one and are favorable towards it. Among young voters, that percentage is even higher, and among young women, even higher than that. So I don't think it's necessarily as poisonous as people are saying. But even so, I would rather see Bernie continue down the path of standing up for what he actually believes in, which is what gives him credibility as a candidate, this long history of running contrary to what the dominant parties, the Democratic Party's interests were, and contrary to their rhetoric and contrary to their general principles in favor of what he actually believes, than to see him start softening now, which I think would diminish his credibility as a candidate.
Natasha, where is Bernie on the ground in Iowa right now? I mean, he, you know, because of his performance in Iowa 4 years ago, I think people had expected him to do a little bit better there than the polls have him right now. Why is he only at 15%?
Well, he is slipping some. He started off at a great advantage. I mean, Biden was still leading Bernie Sanders in Iowa, but he had a great advantage because of all the infrastructure he still had there, huge following. When he announced, he had 19,000 volunteers in Iowa ready to go, like people already signed up behind him. But as things have been rolling out, there are just so many more options this time. I mean, it's not a either-or situation anymore. Obviously, it's not a Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders, so there's a very stark contrast. Now there's all this degradation across spectrum. And, you know, you do have people like Pete Buttigieg, you know, someone new who's coming in, offering some new insights. People are getting excited about him. You have better work, having some excitement. And then, you know, above all is Elizabeth Warren, who, you know, you can argue that I think we've seen analysis nationally, at least, and maybe even in Iowa, where the share of younger voters that have left Bernie appear to be going to Warren and Buttigieg. And that might be a testament to what she's done on the ground. She did swoop up some really good talent there, some caucus experts and some organizational experts. I mean, Bernie's still very competitive there, but you do see him slipping some, and you see Warren going up, and you see Buttigieg also on the rise in Iowa.
One really weird part of this race is you look at Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, one of the national polls this week, I forget which one, but on very liberal voters, they've now split 29-29. But there's a lot of the party that's somewhat liberal or moderate and conservative, and Biden just owns those people with very little competition. So you have almost all the second-tier candidates focused on that very liberal element of the party and leaving Biden all this ideological running room with the rest.
I think part of that is an artifact of non-white respondents in those polls are a lot less likely to describe themselves as very liberal than white Democrats are. And that doesn't even necessarily line up with policy positions. When you survey them on policy questions, you don't necessarily find that non-white Democrats are as far to the right of white Democrats as you'd expect.
They just don't like the
based
term.
On self-ID, but they're less likely to adopt the term very liberal. So part of that, I think, is just showing that Joe Biden is strong with black voters. Especially.
That was interesting.
Natasha, I want to ask you about some of the candidates who aren't at the top of this field. I was surprised to see you single out Cory Booker as a candidate with an especially strong organization in Iowa. He's at 1% in that Des Moines Register poll, so that organization does not seem to be translating yet.
I would point to probably Cory Booker and Beto O'Rourke because the two of them have Booker started as early as Warren did. And I followed him around Iowa some. He isn't attracting these huge, 1,000 people crowds, but the people he is in front of, and you know, they say that's how you have to do it bit by bit in Iowa, come away like pretty inspired. You know, they seem pretty convinced once they see him. So if he's able to continue doing that and gain traction, I can see him, you know, registering pretty toward the top, somewhere toward the top there. And he has been able to do that in a way, I think, that maybe some of the other senators haven't been able to do. Senator Klobuchar, I'm actually surprised she hasn't done better because she's she's from a neighboring state, and you know, she's considered a favorite daughter in some ways. I've heard her described there, and I could see that also changing as we move forward, and if there is a desire by Democrats to have somebody who's, you know, a little more to the center. I'm not sure if that's the case, but she does provide that option. And Beto O'Rourke has just been working really. I don't think anyone has held as many events in Iowa, including Elizabeth Warren, as Beto O'Rourke. He's just been, you know, he's been there nonstop. He's held town hall after town hall. He just opened another office in Cedar Rapids last week, and he brought his wife there. Like, he's all in on Iowa. But still, it's a tough fight, and it's going to be very splintered. I wouldn't be surprised if even by the late summer we see a thinner field, a thinned out field, or at least that's what I keep hearing Democrats there saying they would like to see.
Yeah, it's funny, Liz, as we come up on these debates, which are going to be in a week and a half, you have this enormous field. You have 20 candidates who've made the debate stage, plus Governor Bullock from Montana, who just missed it and is very sad about it. But you also have this race that sort of coalesced around five candidates. And so I hear two different things from Democrats about this. One is I hear concern about, you know, there's too many people in this field, is drawing too many resources. You're going to have a bruising long fight. Maybe you won't have a candidate before the convention, and that's a big problem. I also hear people say things like, you know, Jay Inslee's not going to be the nominee, but I'm glad that he's there to talk about climate change and raise that issue, that these candidates can play a valuable role. Do you care about the non-top five candidates? Do you think that they matter in this process at all?
I mean, they're interesting, and I think that it's pretty obvious that the discourse coming out of the bottom tier candidates has affected the discourse in the top tier. Inslee is a good example of that. Hickenlooper interacting with Sanders after Sanders' speech on socialism actually inspired a pretty big debate, at least among the pundit class. I think that they matter and they have a voice. I don't think that I would name any particular one of them as a likely contender for the end of the game, but I'm pretty neutral as to the size of the field. I don't think it's a direct harm, and it seems to have some benefits.
We're going to have to leave that there. I want to thank Natasha Kerecki, national political correspondent for Politico. Thank you, Natasha.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. After the break, we'll be joined by journalist Carrie Howley, who lives in Iowa City and who just wrote a profile of one of those lower-tier candidates, Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. And we're now joined by Carrie Howley, who is a contributing writer at New York Magazine and a professor at the University of Iowa. She joins us now from Iowa City. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. I want to talk with you about this sort of wild profile you've written on Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. But first, can you tell me what it's like in Iowa City right now? How is this parade of presidential candidates treating you?
As someone who lives here, it can be slightly annoying. There's 24 candidates. There's not a lot of public spaces in Iowa City, not as much as a big city. So it can be disruptive. You know, you want to take your kid for froyo, but Tulsi Gabbard is standing in front of the froyo machine giving a speech about Iraq. Or, you know, you want to I have a favorite bar that also seems to be the favorite bar of like Cory Booker and a variety of other candidates. So it's like, It can just seem like an onslaught. And also it's almost sad. There's like a neediness on the part of the candidates because people aren't that engaged yet. And you can see that the candidates are worried about empty rooms, right? Like they're desperate for attention. But the attitude in people in Iowa City, at least, seems to be like, they'll be back. You know, there's no urgency among voters because they know that they'll be courted for a long time to come.
So your profile is about one of those candidates who's been getting less attention, which I think is inevitable in a field of 24. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of layers, and we'll get to some of the personal ones in a moment. But one thread I found going through your piece is sort of an idea that the Gabbard campaign is a missed opportunity, that she's running on mm-hmm. some under-discussed foreign policy issues. She has some critiques of the foreign policy establishment and the choices that it has made under both parties. And I think you're at least somewhat sympathetic to those critiques. But she's not proved an effective messenger for them, and voters don't seem very interested in hearing about foreign policy anyway. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's fair. You know, it's interesting. I saw her in Fairfield, and she didn't seem to be connecting with the crowd initially. She was talking about nuclear war, which I think would feel urgent in Hawaii, but less so in Iowa. And it wasn't until she changed course and started talking about Medicare for all and climate change, just like surefire domestic applause lines, that the audience really seemed engaged. But later she came back to Iowa and she had improved her stump speech such that she was connecting foreign policy to domestic concerns. So it was kind of like, well, why can't we have nice things? Why can't we have Medicare for all? Why aren't we addressing climate change? Well, one reason is because we've spent, untold treasure on forever war. So, you know, connecting the financial costs of war to domestic, cheapness. And that really seemed to hit in a big way. So, I mean, I think she's becoming a better messenger. At the same time, it's an uphill battle. And most candidates aren't really motivated to fight that battle because foreign policy isn't necessarily something that they're personally motivated by.
Liz, I think a problem for Tulsi Gabbard as a candidate is that it's unclear to people whether she's a left-wing candidate or not. She sort of has this grab bag of foreign policy positions. She makes these criticisms of forever wars and foreign wars that I think get a lot of sympathy from broadly in the party now, but especially from the left of the party. But then she's taken some other stances on things related to terrorism, criticizing Barack Obama for not talking enough about radical Islamic terrorism as a specific named concept that have turned off people to the left of the party. So I guess the question is she actually a good messenger for certain ideas about reducing U.S. interventionism given the broad spectrum of positions she's taken?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely what's holding her back, right, is this history of positions that are kind of dissonant with what the anti-war left wing of the party wants to hear. And I think that Carrie's profile got into quite a bit of that. A lot of her positions seem to have to do with her upbringing. She has a sort of sympathy, it appears, with certain Hindu nationalist movements that disturb the left flank of the party. You can see where quite a bit of that comes from, but it does make her a complicated messenger for what is a genuinely good anti-war message on the left.
Yeah, well, so let's talk about the upbringing, because, Carrie, your profile is titled Tulsi Gabbard Had a Very Strange Childhood. Why is her childhood important for understanding her or her campaign?
Right. So she grew up in the sect that revolves around a charismatic leader named Chris Butler. And people from that sect continue to be deeply involved with the campaign. Chris Butler's father was an anti-war activist that seems to have influenced her. I think the dramatic question behind that piece is what is going on with Tulsi Gabbard? Because as Liz was saying, there doesn't seem to be a coherent ideology that is easily articulable about her philosophy. So there are other party mavericks, right? Like, okay, Ron Paul, he doesn't vote with the party, but I understand where he's coming from and can predict where he's going to fall on any particular issue. Same with Bernie Sanders. Tulsi Gabbard isn't like that. It is strange to be a non-interventionist who votes to make it nearly impossible for Syrian and Iraqi refugees to come into the country, or to be a committed vocal non-interventionist who actually supports intervention in the case of drone wars against ISIS. These take a little bit of explaining. And so one answer might be this really interesting idiosyncratic upbringing.
So you really assiduously avoid using the word cult in this piece, but it kind of sounds like you're describing a cult.
I actually use the cult when I'm talking about the blob, when I'm talking about the cult of
right.
war.
Right, but I mean about this.
But yeah, no, I know what you mean. I leave that to the reader I encourage you to read the piece and make your own distinctions. It's a sect. It's not Hare Krishna, but Chris Butler had once been Hare Krishna. So it shares some aspects of Hare Krishna ritual. And even dissenters, people who have left the group and found it controlling and overbearing, not all of them would call it a cult, although certainly some would.
But so I guess why does this matter? I mean, certainly the Gabbard people take great umbrage at the idea that this is important for understanding her. They criticize this as being essentially Hindu phobic to even bring this up. Why should we focus on this aspect of her background?
Sure. Well, there are people very highly placed in the campaign, including her chief of staff, who are still associated with the sect. You know, her husband, her sister, people with whom she traveled to Iowa and abroad. So it's essentially unknowable how deeply she still remains tied to them. And also, you know, a politician's background that has a loud silence around it, someone running for president, is, you know, fair game for a journalist. And she can, she doesn't really have a story about it. I mean, there's just this loud silence and, as you said, umbrage at even bringing it up. But I think it's an interesting American story about an idiosyncratic childhood and a fascinating politician.
Rich, it feels like there could be a simpler story about the grab bag of foreign policy positions that Gabbard has, which is that she's a Jacksonian in the way that the president sometimes tries to present himself as a Jacksonian, which is to say skeptical of foreign entanglements but willing to use overwhelming force to protect the U.S. when there are threats directly to the homeland. You could sort of piece together a sort of, you know, an anti-war hawk view of her that is similar to maybe what Steve Bannon would have had the president do rather than what the president has actually done.
Yeah, or hardcore realist, where we're going to cooperate with these malign regimes when it's supposedly in our interest. For instance, in counterterrorism operations, was what she wants to do with Russia and Syria, Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria. And there might be more openness to this typically in Democratic Party politics, certainly with regard to Russia, but this is exactly the wrong time to say we need to work with Vladimir Putin, given the reaction there's been among Democrats to the allegations that Trump was somehow colluding with the Russians.
Yeah, so, Liz, what do you make of those criticisms that have come to Gabbard from both sides of the aisle? I mean, for example, for the meeting that she took with Bashar al-Assad in early 2017, what Kerry describes in the profile is sort of, you know, these efforts by cable news hosts to get Gabbard to say negative things about Assad and her sort of demurring on them, saying, well, he's not an adversary of the U.S., is the criticism of her over that fair? Should she have taken that meeting with Assad?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think if you're going to take meetings with leaders like Assad, you need to have a very clear account of what your goal was and what your position is. And I think that that's exactly what she came up short on after the fact, right? When she would talk about the meeting with Assad, like you say, there would be these moments of unclarity where she wouldn't exactly supply a reason for the meeting or what she had come out thinking of it or what her position was as a result of it. I think that spooked people, especially on the left flank of the party, and I think with good reason. And it all goes back to exactly what Kerry is pointing out, is this unpredictability where it's pretty hard to infer from Gabbard's behavior what she's actually thinking. And I think that puts voters at a disadvantage when it comes to trying to evaluate her.
So, Kerry, where does this leave Gabbard's anti-war messages within the Democratic Party? I mean, obviously, you have Bernie Sanders as a much more prominent candidate who is sympathetic mm-hmm. to a number of the positions that she has. But, I mean, you know, both Gabbard has been poorly received in the party, but also to a significant extent has not been received at all. She's one of these candidates mm-hmm. who hasn't really broken through. Do you see that message coming out elsewhere in the field?
I think I see it remaining with her extremely intense and committed supporters. And in some ways, I understand that intensity because her supporters don't really have anywhere else to turn. I mean, I think Bernie Sanders has moved to articulate a more moderate foreign policy. You know, he wants to build a global movement, he says. It's hard to know exactly what that means. But if you are someone who really worries about forever wars, the humanitarian and financial cost of that, I don't know that you have many other places to go besides Tulsi Gabbard. And so she has this very intense, motivated coalition.
Kerry Halley, contributing writer at New York Magazine, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Nearly 200 CEOs of U.S. businesses signed a full-page New York Times ad supporting abortion, not because it's a supposed right, not because it's a tragic reality in our country, but because it's a positive good that makes their workforces better, which may be an uncomfortable message for women at these firms who are or who are planning to become mothers.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
So already every week you can see a new report on who's in, who's out, and who's done for in the Democratic primary. But I would advise everybody to beware of early polling. It's still many months until the Iowa caucuses and many more until the end of the primaries. Look at who was where in the 2016 Republican field in June of 2015, and you might find yourself hesitating to call who's in, who's out, dead, slipping, done for, or on the rise.
For my rant, competition among cell phone providers has been serving Americans well. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the price of wireless service has fallen 28% in the last decade. Over the same period, less competitive wired services have gone up in price, landline phone service by 18%, cable TV by 30%. But competition in wireless is at risk because two of the largest players, Sprint and T-Mobile, have agreed to merge. This would give all the wireless companies more power to raise prices, and it would be bad for consumers. Trump administration officials face a choice about whether to approve this merger or try to block it. But the choice isn't all theirs. State attorney generals are suing, saying that the merger violates antitrust laws. President Trump seemed to understand the problem with telecom mergers when he had a personal stake in the matter. The substantive argument against Sprint T-Mobile is much stronger than the argument against AT&T Time Warner because Sprint and T-Mobile are direct competitors. But neither Sprint nor T-Mobile owns a cable network where people say mean things about the president, so he doesn't seem to care. It's a good thing that we have state officials here to pick up the baton. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Natasha Karecki, and Carrie Howley. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Berskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.